yeah, it's just a bit strange not having any events, because normally it'd be sort of out and about meeting people or kind of making some arrangements for those kind of things. But obviously it's a very different campaign this year. It's all online, isn't it? It's all just digital, and it's just a bit odd. It's just and not having the sort of buzz of the office and things like that as well.
Yeah, I've already started recording, by the way, because I thought, why not? But and I've also now just looked at my laptop battery and just thought, shit. So one second. That moment when you realise you've got 11% battery. Which is not a lot of time in laptop land, I've found.
No.
Especially when I'm charging my phone off the laptop as well. But yeah, I've started.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Pardon?
That'll do it, if you charge your phone.
Yeah, because that's on 5%. So pretty screwed there. So I've started recording anyway. I have to say it so that anyone doesn't get freaked out.
No, it's fine.
And yeah, so Movember this year is weird, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just odd. I mean, we've always been a sort of digital based campaign. It's always been sort of peer to peer fundraising focused. So there's been a big element has been the website and our social media, and not relying too much on kind of events. It's not been too difficult to adapt in that sense. But obviously, as I was saying, it is strange just not having that and restricting the options for what people can do to kind of, raise funds and awareness as well. And I guess we were lucky compared to some other charities in that we've had a few months to kind of prepare and shift the messaging. We were always kind of aware that we might not be able to have events at all. So I think we're in a pretty good position for it generally, but yeah, definitely strange. And obviously the whole focus has been around mental health and isolation and sort of encouraging people to stay connected and check in with friends.
Do you find that, so I wanted to do this podcast with you. First, I'm going to start with this. I never really know how to pronounce your name.
So Oswin, Oswin. Yeah, Oswin.
So I know another Oswin, but he insists he's called Owen.
He insists on that?
Yeah.
Okay, I complain about that because people always call me Owen.
It is Owen.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, Oswin, but everyone just calls me Ozzy. It's an unusual one. But you don't come across many Oswins. There's quite a few people who have Oswin as a surname, especially in America, I think. But yeah, it's Old English.
Old English or Old Scottish, though?
Old English, yes. It's from like Northumbria, I think is the name. There was a King Oswin of Northumbria. And it's just I guess the Anglo-Saxon. But yeah, my dad's English, so I'm like half Scottish, half English.
Okay.
Yeah.
And for me, I've been wanting to do a podcast which is kind of talking about Movember and what Movember does while we're in the month of November as it is. And as you can see, we're both sporting pretty terrible moustaches right now.
Mine's awful every year. It doesn't get any easier. It's so much ginger, and I've got like a lopsided moustache as well. There's like a gap there. Yeah.
Yours has come along.
Yeah.
It's getting there.
Getting there. Yeah. Not too bad.
The problem I have is I've always suffered from really bad eczema, and that's why I normally have a beard, because it covers it up.
So yeah.
You can kind of see I have like a few little patchy bits around my chin.
I can't really see on the.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just because of the eczema. So I mean, my skin is exfoliated and moisturized very, very well right now to try and reduce that. But it's one of those things that's why I normally have a beard, is to cover that up.
Yeah.
But then I made this point since Australia of whenever I've done like these kind of challenges on the bike, of shaving my mustache. Just, and I don't, it all started originally because it was a dare.
Right.
And the dare was between me and my mate Francis, where I said to him, I will shave a mustache for the whole of Australia if you bleach your hair. I don't know who got the worst deal there, to be honest with you.
Well, I think bleaching your hair is all right. It's when it starts to grow out and become frosted tips.
Yeah, that's really bad.
But yeah, I mean, that's kind of how November started. It was a dare in a way. It was two mates in a pub trying to bring the mustache back. And they challenged their mates to do it. So yeah, it started off with just like 30 guys in Melbourne in Australia doing it. And then, yeah, it grew from there.
So I think I first heard of it, it's probably 7 years ago.
Yeah, so that was 2003 that they did it the first time. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of officially came to the UK shores 2006, 2007. But obviously it kind of spread before then on Facebook. This was kind of when Facebook was first taking off. And Movember really benefited from that kind of social media challenge. It was one of along with like Ice Bucket Challenge, one of the first sort of charity drives to benefit from Facebook. And I don't think the guys ever really intended to take it beyond Australia. It just sort of happened, and then they were like, "Well, we can have campaigns in other countries." So some of them stopped sticks and left. One of the co-founders, one of the original kind of like 30 guys, moved to the UK, and he's still involved.
That's nice.
With our campaign. Yeah, so it's a real kind of like grassroots movement that sort of came out of nowhere. The guys weren't doing stuff for charity before. They worked in sort of commercial backgrounds. And it's quite strange, yeah, because it was, you know, the activity and the branding and stuff evolved before the cause. They weren't going to do it, they just did it for fun the first time. Mm-hmm. And then they were like, well, there's something in this, let's do it for a good cause. And they sort of stumbled across prostate cancer initially as their first cause, as being like a male only cancer, and growing a mustache tends to be male only as well. There's notable exceptions.
Yeah.
So they grew out of that and started working with the Prostate Cancer Foundation in Australia, and then started partnering with other prostate cancer charities around the world. Prostate Cancer UK here. And then it branched out into other cause areas, testicular cancer and mental health. The guys who'd started Movember had lost friends to suicide, so they saw that obviously it was the whole sort of talking about your mental health was a struggle for men. So, and Movember being a male focused charity activity, they said, well, why don't we adopt this cause as well? So that was 2006, I think, when they started doing stuff with Beyond Blue in Australia. Mm-hmm. The mental health charity there, and then it was always partnering with other charities initially, but now Movember is sort of moving away from that and becoming an entity within itself that delivers programs and sort of self-sufficient.
And one of the things that's really great is the amount of resources that are actually on the website. There's so much information. I know it sounds like almost a cliche thing to say, like a charity having loads of information on the website, but actually it's the fact of how clear it is. It's very easy to absorb. I've often found like the charity side of it, that quite often that sort of element is quite hard to absorb in a tangible way. As you know, I'm dyslexic. So for me, things that are easy to absorb and simple to kind of respond to really, really works. And I think the website is really very well done. It's very easy and accessible for anyone to understand.
Yeah, it's great to hear. Yeah, I mean, you do worry because obviously like mental health and prostate cancer especially, it's very like quite complicated, conditions. It's different for everyone. So it's hard to give advice because everyone's kind of different. You know, with the prostate cancer side of things, We still don't have sort of really reliable initial tests for it, and that's, you know, something we're trying to fund and work on. But the advice for men is can be a bit sort of complicated. It's sort of like, well, maybe you should go to the doctor. Maybe you should get the test, but then be aware that there's downsides of the test because it might not be accurate. You might end up being treated for, you know, you might end up taking treatment that's more than what you needed. You know, you might be diagnosed with prostate cancer, but it'll be quite often it's benign or not. You know, there's different treatment paths that you have to choose between. So it is a complicated journey. So there's obviously been a lot of work done on that information on the website about, you know, what to do. And we've got a kind of simple message now of, you know, speak to your doctor if you're over 50 about having having a PSA test, which is just a blood test, or if you're sort of in an at-risk category, do it at 40, 45. So that's, you know, people with a family history of prostate cancer, or black men are genetically more likely to get prostate cancer as well. So those risk factors kind of increase your likelihood of having the disease by quite a lot. So that's a kind of basic message, but it does get a lot more complicated when you look into it further.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's, you know, it's an incredibly sensitive subject for men and, you know, people internationally. Like, I think now in the modern world, if you haven't been affected by cancer in some way, shape or form, you're very, very lucky. In fact, I would imagine, I couldn't tell you the stats, but I would imagine that most people now have probably been affected in it in some way, whether it's from a relative or a friend. I know myself, I've, you know, both of my grandparents passed away from cancer, and I had a scare myself when I was 20 as well. So I know that, like, I've seen firsthand how it can affect, you know, me, and also how it affects my family and stuff for when I had the scare myself. And so it's, and us as guys, we are shit at talking about when we need anything. We're just terrible at it. I know I'm probably better than a lot of guys, and I'm still terrible. And I think, so,
I know. There's loads of factors in that, isn't there? There's kind of that old-fashioned perception that showing emotions is weakness. There's sort of established perception that men need to be providers and man up and not show any signs of weakness, and they can't fail. Then there's, you know, education and growing up. You know, men probably don't talk about their health or personal issues growing up, or don't talk about going to the doctor regularly in the way that women might. So there's, you know, this powder keg of all these pressures that stop us from seeking help or going to the doctor or talking about, you know, our mental health. So, you know, we're trying to break that down, and this, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. You can talk about encouraging men to come forward and talk, but then there's also the traffic goes the other way. You know, can we reach out to people and be proactive about helping them? Because when we were talking about men's health and opening up and stuff like that, a lot of guys said, well, I reached out for help and no one kind of answered the call, or, you know, they sort of got scared because I started, you know, showing emotions, or it was, you know, they didn't want to deal with my, you know, my problems. Mm. Or they said, you know, no one's asked me, you know, just quite simply, no one's ever asked how I'm doing. So that's something we're trying to tackle as well. Like, here's how to have conversations. Here's what to look out for in other people. And if someone does come to you with a problem, here's the things that you can say. Here's things to try and sort of avoid in conversation. Don't, you know, try not to shut it down or just sort of dismiss their problems, or try and give them solutions. You know, ask questions and have a discussion about how you're going to try and get out of this problem.
And that's the, it's, I think I saw it on the website. It's the ALEC thing, isn't it?
Yeah, ALEC model is really useful, actually. Ask, listen, encourage action, check in. So, yeah, I mean, I found it useful when having tough conversations with guys, because it just kind of keeps it in your mind, you know, like, you know, ask a question, listen, you know, shut up for a bit and don't jump in with solutions, and then, you know, ask them what can you do to make things better. Maybe, you know, you probably can't solve their problems. You know, if someone's got mental health issues, it's probably because of factors which are out with their control, like family illness, or they've lost a job, or a relationship has broken down, and you can't fix it. You know, those things are, you know, money problems. You can't just click your fingers and solve them. You can't say just do this. You know, if they were gonna be able to fix those problems easily by themselves, then, you know, they would have done it. So the reason they're speaking to you about their problem is because they just want to get it off their chest and share the load. So, you know, you just ask them further, you know, what steps can you do? Maybe you can't change the situation, but you can maybe change the way you think about it, and you can do some simple things to kind of make yourself feel better, which is talk or exercise, eat better. Quite sort of simple steps, which we kind of all know we should do, but maybe we don't always do. So, you know, if someone's struggling, well, here's some simple steps to start dealing with the situation. And then, you know, hopefully they go away and do it. Maybe they don't, so you check back in and see where they are.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's really important, isn't it? It's the checking back in and checking in. And sometimes that can be the thing that deters someone from potentially something worse, you know?
Yes, exactly. And it can just be...
Go on, off to you.
I was just going to say, it can just be a simple text, you know? It can just be a, how are you feeling? Or just, you know, doing that thing, sticking something in the diary, saying, you know, message your mate.
One of the things that I found is, like, even just sending a funny GIF, because it acknowledges that you're thinking of them without actually, you don't have to say anything, and sometimes people don't want you to say anything, but it just acknowledges that you're aware and thinking of them. And like, there's some brilliant GIFs out there. Like, I've done my research. There's some great GIFs.
That's a really great idea, because you don't have to say anything. It just says, you know, you're on my mind and I'm here if you want to talk.
Yeah. And have you found, like, I guess this year as well with Movember, it's been such a volatile year for many, many people. We seem to be continually hearing of not very nice things that happened. I don't imagine that the stats are yet out there, but I feel that this year there's been more of an outcry of people who are struggling. And also I've noticed personally that there seems to be more people who are choosing to take their lives. And because of the additional pressures that we've had this year, I don't know the stats, but I can imagine that this year it could be higher than previous years.
Yeah, with the suicide statistics, I've heard bits from people saying that rates are up. I haven't seen anything sort of official, sort of nationwide statistics yet. Mm. There's been some issues with reporting of deaths as well, especially during the sort of first lockdown. There was delays in sort of reporting on statistics and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, we did a survey of men about you know, their mental well-being. So, and obviously most men have said that they're facing extra pressures because of coronavirus, but the big takeaway was, you know, it was 50% plus of guys said that no one had checked in with them, no one had asked them how they're feeling. So that was our kind of big focus. You know, you do need to check in with your friends, and a lot of people are feeling isolated because they've not got the normal social interactions of going to work perhaps, or, you know, going to the pub or seeing their friends. So yeah, that was kind of our big takeaway. But yeah, with regards to sort of mental health and suicide statistics, yeah, still got to kind of see how big an impact it is, but you can pretty much safely say that obviously it will have a huge, huge impact with people losing jobs and all the restrictions in place. Especially, you know, think about older people as well, or people who are shielding, like this extended kind of period of isolation must be sort of wreaking havoc with them.
Yeah, and I mean, you and I are probably in a very, we're in the, maybe the minority of it being younger, and also, I guess, in the south of the UK, like we don't, I know that I've got friends that live up north as well, and it seems to be at some points, can't speak for older men or women at that point, but I can imagine that if you're sort of up north, and a bit isolated from a town or a city as well, like it could be really, really tough right now.
I think we're quite a privileged position. A lot of people having it really tough, especially up north. Yeah, I've got, you know, a friend in Manchester who's, you know, had to deal with all the restrictions after just moving there and stuff like that. And it's definitely a strain. And I guess northern communities as well might be more at risk as well, you know, economically too, with the added restrictions as well that have been going on for longer. So yeah, I think you just have to step out of your own kind of circle and think about others and think about where you could make a difference. And those people who, you know, reach out to those people who are at risk as well, and sort of just being aware of that.
Mm-hmm. And it feels very much that Movember's campaign this year has been, to me anyway, it feels a lot like there's been a massive push on that, reaching out to people and the mental health side of it.
Yeah, so we accelerated a couple of our like digital tools as well, because we knew, like digital mental health tools, because we knew that people might need them. So we have Movember Conversations, which is just a site to kind of guide you through having a tough conversation with a friend. It sort of role plays you through some scenarios and gives you suggestions of what to say or what to kind of avoid saying. So we weren't going to release that until I think around about now during the campaign. But we basically brought it out in May. We kind of rushed it forward and said, look, this is worth doing now. This is what people are asking for. This is where we can make our difference. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, yeah, that's the area where we, you know, we're trying to make the biggest difference. Is sort of, we sort of imagine a triangle at the point, the top, the pointy end. That's the kind of acute crisis area where you have, you know, suicide helplines and people being admitted to care and such like. There's a lot of good work going on there, but, you know, we want to try and get to guys before they reach that point and get them to seek help before their mental health deteriorates further. So it's kind of at the community sort of social end of things. If we could, you know, the theory being, if we could, you know, equip everyone to be educated on mental health and know what to do to support other people, then that could have you know, a much bigger impact on sort of the end goal, which is bringing down suicide rates.
So there's, I mean, I feel like we've talked a lot of the more slightly negative things about what's currently happening, but I think it'd be really good to like maybe discuss some of the real success points that have come out of November.
Yeah. No, we've seen amazing support this year. We've had more people sign up than last year already. You know, we've had 100,000 in the UK sign up. And yeah. So it's actually been, you know, a good year for us and with that metric anyway. And just sort of anecdotally from my side of things, just seen lots of amazing things going on. Challenges people are taking on because they want to help other people. And lots of people talking about, you know, the campaign has kind of spurred me to get help or reach out to people. Dozens of guys taking on sort of insane physical challenges like yourself. How is that going, by the way? How's training?
Well, like I said to you before I started recording, I was on the turbo this morning and I'm still in Lycra. So yeah, training. I feel good, actually. I've had, I think I've nearly done 3 weeks of three big weeks now. I feel like my legs have come back to life a bit, which is mentally is quite nice to know. It was definitely a big concern because I had to take time off after that last challenge. I just needed it physically, mentally. Like I was cooked, absolutely cooked. And but I knew timing wise it was going to be really close, as in like, have I really got enough time to get myself back up to a point where I can complete it? Like, I have no doubt I wouldn't have been able to have completed the challenge, but completing it feeling less fucked. Like, I'm still, whatever happens, I'm going to be fucked at the end of it, but like, there's different degrees of fucked, and I don't want to be the bottom degree of fucked. I'd like to be like mid tier fucked. And so I kind of.
Have you ever found yourself sort of hitting a real low after one of your big challenges?
Every single time. Every single time, I really struggle with it. And I think I definitely struggled with it this time. And I think a lot of that came from the fact of how monumental it was. Like, it was the hardest challenge I've done to date. Not just physically, but mentally. So hard. Like I really struggled with anxiety towards the end of it, and I've struggled with depression in the past, and I know how to kind of manage that. I'm quite good at being aware of how to manage that, and I know how to get support for that and who to talk to and that kind of thing. Like, I have one friend in particular who, if I'm struggling that way, is the person that I talk to, and he knows it and he's brilliant for it. But the anxiety thing, I've never ever been an anxious person. I've never known to be anxious. I've never struggled with it. And so it caught me off guard. It really caught me off guard. And I put it down to a combination of a few things. One of them is basically chronic fatigue. Like, I was exhausted, physically and mentally exhausted. And then I also put it down to the fact that the challenge was so structured. Like, I had to do a certain distance every day. And it wasn't just the fact that I had to do that distance, is what I had, as it was then that I needed to get to a destination, and then I needed to recover, rest, and do it again the next day. And it started to flare up probably about a week into the challenge. It's 3 weeks it was, and it was probably about a week in that it started to flare up. And I remember thinking, this is something I did not expect. It's literally what I was just like, I can't cover it up. I just have to accept it. It's part of the challenge, effectively. And
is it the expectations you set on yourself?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I never doubted that I wouldn't complete it. I doubted probably how I would feel at the end. I felt a lot better than I thought I would. You know, one of the big issues that I struggle with, and I've struggled with it for, well, it's probably a year now, and it's something that I'm never going to recover, is I have quite bad nerve damage in one of my hands. And so it means that when I get fatigued, I struggle to literally grip onto a handlebar. And it's little things like shifting becomes harder. So I've been writing this like blog post, which has taken me ages to write, and it's all about what I call barriers to completion. So what I class as barriers to completion, like a really simple one for me, is with training, my turbo trainer is in my bedroom and it always has a bike on it. So a barrier to completion is not having a bike on the turbo trainer. So having to set up a bike, but like, it's just something you have to do. So the night before, when I know I've got, especially when it's a hard session, it's like, all right, lay up, put the kit next to the bike, put the shoes next to the bike, make sure it's all ready to go. So in the morning, I just have to get on it. And one of the things with this challenge, one of these barriers to completion, was being able to manage and control this nerve damage in my hands, because it's incredibly painful when it flares up. And so how I did that was I made sure that the bike I was riding had like electronic gears, so DI2 on it, which means that what it is on DI2 shifting, it's like a button click like that, so it's hardly any movement. With a cable shifting, it's literally, the movement is like this with your hands. So most bikes that have like a, you know, the Mexi control by a cable, you think when you change the gear, you push your hand in to change it like that. Mm. That motion, I can feel it doing it now, is what causes me a lot of pain.
Yeah.
Taking away as many of these barriers to completion for the challenge was really important. And that was like one of them. There's loads of examples. But I never doubted that I couldn't do it. I doubted, as I said, how I would feel at the end. And I had maybe one big wobble in Bristol, which was 5 days in. And that was because the first 5 days were so hard. They were the hardest in the challenge. Yeah. And that was due to the elevation. Like the Southwest is so hilly, but it's not like gradual hills. It's like, it's as hard going up as it is going down, because the descents are always quite technical, really tight roads, normally shit surfaces, and then that go up and they're like, you know, 20%+ descents. So yeah, it was tough. It was really tough. And I didn't expect to struggle with the anxiety like I did. But it's part of the challenge. And I feel that during the challenges, I'm quite good at generally switching off the emotional side. Obviously it does come up, and as it should do every now and then, but I can switch it off most of the time. The same with like the 24-hour things. The 24-hour things, I think I just turn into a robot, and it does nothing. No emotion comes out until the end of it, and then it's emotional. But after this challenge, I needed to just take just over a month off the bike, pretty much, and away from anything like that, because I just needed to not think about it and not train, not ride, like actually want to get on a bike again. And my concern was like, so with this challenge that I'm doing for November, which is a trenching challenge. So we've talked about this a lot. It's effectively descending to the depth of the Mariana Trench, which is 11,034 meters. Obviously to descend that, you have to climb that. So I was really, I was a bit concerned on how much time I could take off, to then how much I would need to then get my legs back working again, to then being able to do the challenge successfully. And I think I've juggled it right. I think, because I feel all right.
You don't really know, do you?
I don't know, to be perfectly honest. I don't know. And I won't know until I've done the challenge. But I've penned in a date now. I'm going to do it on the 28th.
28th. Okay, yeah. Cool.
So it's going to be interesting. It's going to be, you're getting on the calendar.
I'm writing it down, because that was actually something I was going to ask you. Because I was trying to find the date. I was like, has he told me and I've forgotten? And then I'd seen you said end of October, but not a date. So
good to know. 28th I'm going to do it on, because it's the end of the month, and I feel like I will have a good moustache then as well. So
good for them.
Hopefully.
I find 3 weeks is enough to show a decent moustache. If it's 3 weeks for me, then you'll be fine.
Yeah, so I mean, it's gonna be in the with that challenge, like with every challenge I always have a notebook in front of me. This is a known thing, and I think you probably know this as well. Like, I spend a lot of time thinking and trying to understand. Like, there's just like loads of pages of just bullshit, to be honest with you. But I try to create a story of a challenge, and try to, for me, it's all storytelling.
Yeah.
And this is a problem I have on my desk, because it gets so bright.
I get the same as well, usually, but
I genuinely have my sunglasses on the desk all the time. So for me, we were talking about it a while, and one of the key sort of statistics that stuck out of what you told me was 91 men a week in the UK take their own life. And that really stuck with me, and I found it alarmingly high. I think it's going to be higher at the end of this year. I do, but I found it alarmingly high. And so I was trying to find a hill that I could rep 91 times, to descend it 91 times, which means you'd have to climb it 92 times, unless you start at the top, but you're going to start at the bottom.
Yeah.
Um, And ironically, that's Box Hill, which is quite convenient.
Yeah.
It works out quite conveniently. So, yeah, it definitely helps the fact that it's relatively local. And I had concerns about whether I was going to be able to do this still because of, you know, we're in another lockdown again. Is this lockdown going to be extended? Who knows?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of chance that it could be. And then I was looking into the rules and stuff. There's no rules. Oh, hello.
Sorry. There's a baby crying outside my window, which was open.
Sorry, my neighbour was... He's got a rowing machine, and I can hear it when he's doing it.
There's usually a guy doing karate in his garden near me. That's worse, because there's a lot of hype.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So it makes you do it every time.
Yeah, so the first time it was happening, I was like, what's going on? Like, is someone having a fight over there? I was like, no, it's a guy practicing karate in his garden.
In the summer, I had an ice cream truck that used to appear. So in the early podcasts, before I was recording the video ones, when I was just doing the audio ones, every now and then you could hear this ice cream truck in the background. And
yeah,
I shit you not, I have all my windows closed in the flat, and it sounds like he's like pumped up the speakers to the max. Like,
yeah,
really dialed it up so that he can catch everyone's attention. It's so loud, and you can hear it in the podcasts. With the current rules, I can still do the challenge. It's not restricted that, you know, it's restricted if anyone wants to come along, but there's no reason why I can't still do it as it stands. Worst case scenario, I'll do it on Zwift, which is probably shitter, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's not quite the same, is it? But, you know, having a COVID-proof solution is kind of part of all my conversations these days, just because you just don't know. I've had too many people having to cancel really, really great sort of fundraising ideas or events because of restrictions. And it's, yeah, always good to have a plan B.
Yeah, definitely. And there is always a way. I don't know. I always think there is a way around it. Like, you can always find a solution, and that's part of what makes it, for me anyway, like with the 107 ride that I did, that was like the third iteration of what it was going to be. It wasn't the original idea. That was the third option. And it's just allowing yourself to be flexible, to be able to adjust and change. I remember one of my like mentors, who was my tutor when I was at uni, he said to me, you want to be like a speedboat, because a speedboat's really agile and nimble. You don't want to ever be a battleship, because a battleship just plows through and goes in a straight line, but a speedboat can dodge and dive stuff. And that analogy always stuck to me, you know, and it's kind of like been something that I've always thought about with anything. As I say, it meant that the 107 challenge, that was the third variation of it. The first one was to go to effectively ride the whole tour non-stop, including all the transfers, because the association was the 107th tour.
Yeah,
and that would have been fucking hard, like really hard. It would have been as hard as the challenge I did, but then that then got stripped back to just riding the tour effectively, because of it being following a convoy would work out a bit easier. Then I was just like, I don't actually feel comfortable with the idea of traveling to France, so stripped it back even more. And then that's when I started planning in the UK, and then doing the challenge actually was effectively being followed by regional lockdowns. So when I was in Durham, for example, the next, I think 2 days later, the regional lockdown came in the northeast. So it's like this weird trying to juggle it the whole way.
Yeah,
I was lucky to have completed it, definitely.
Yeah, I did it just in the nick of time.
Yeah. But the trenching challenge should be, it's definitely going to be done. It's just a variation of whether it will be at Box Hill or in my bedroom on the turbo. I'm swaying towards doing it on Box Hill because that was where I wanted to do it originally. Yeah. But we'll see. Hopefully I can do it.
Yeah. Do you think you'll be able to have anyone there at all? Like even just one or two people kind of cheering you on?
So my tactic at the moment is I don't own a car, so I'm going to rent a car, drive the car down, fill it with food, fill it with spares, fill it with kit, park it somewhere, top of Box Hill, bottom of Box Hill, I haven't decided yet, park it and just get repping. And then, so the regulation states at the moment that you can have you're allowed to have one person ride with you.
Yeah.
Which is fine. So like if someone wanted to come and do a couple of reps, they could come, and then someone else could come and do a couple of reps afterwards in theory.
Yeah.
But then there's also some weird kind of loopholes, I guess, in the regulation where you could argue that if you're doing something for work, you can have more support in a sense.
Mm.
And it's a tricky one. I don't really want to cross it, but
Certain provisions for charitable activities, but whether that's sort of what you're doing falls into that is kind of open to interpretation, isn't it?
One of the things is like one of my friends, who's a guy that documented the 107 challenge, he's going to come down and get some videos and photos and stuff of this challenge anyway. So, but equally, he's very respectful of the fact that like he was brilliant in the challenge as well. When I did the challenge of like, you know, keeping distance, following protocols, everything like that. And so it's the same. I trust him to do that, which is great. Because, you know, it's as important as it is of actually doing it, people want to see that it's done as well, if that makes sense. Like, part of it is going, oh, it's on Strava or Komoot or whatever, but people want to actually, what I found is people want to see you suffering. Like, it seems to do better with donations to anything, I found, which is shit, because it means you have to suffer. But
it's true, though. I mean, it's true, you know, if you put yourself through a physical ordeal, it does encourage people to donate more. It's I guess it's a psychological thing, but yeah, it's a shame. I've done a couple of marathons and raised a lot of money through that, more than I ever would have doing anything else, but definitely broke me a bit.
I could never do a marathon.
I can't either. It's like my body gives up around 20 miles, I think. You can imagine, well, I can't imagine really what you were going through with your previous challenge, but you know, got a glimpse of that, you know, when you get to that physical breaking point and you're like, well, I just can't go on any further. I can't run more anymore. Yeah. I can hobble along, but I'm in agony and things are seizing up and just doesn't feel possible right now. And the idea that you have to do another, you know, few miles that day is you know, mildly traumatizing, because you're like, you know, I just want this to end, and your body's screaming that, you know, it does need to end, but you're going on. So I mean, I just have, you know, a couple of hours of that. I couldn't imagine, you know, days on end of, oh shit, I've got to do it again tomorrow kind of thing.
I think that's where like the anxiety side of it comes in, is that, oh shit, I've got to do it again tomorrow.
Yeah. It's the dread, isn't it? It's the idea that you're going to reach that point again.
I noticed that when it was the second to last day and I was riding through like Norwich Way, and I was actually talking to a friend about it yesterday, which is in the, what will be, episode 31 of the podcast. This is going to be episode 32. So I recorded episode 31 yesterday with a guy called Richard Mitchelson, who's the illustrator he's an illustrator, and he used to do all the illustrations for like Team Sky and Ruler magazine. Just a lovely guy. And anyway, he came out and rode with me on the second to last day. And at that point, we were allowed to ride in groups of six. So it's fine. It's quite good. I think there was six of us actually. And the guys I was with were like, oh, should we stop at a cafe to get some lunch? And I was like, yeah, I'm cool with that, as long as it's quick, basically.
Yeah.
I got to this cafe and had a massive queue outside it. And I was like, nope, we need to go. And they were like, really? I'm like, yeah, we need to go. This isn't going to work. And that was when I really noticed that, like, the anxiety was just going through the roof, was because I was just like, not comfortable in this situation. How long, if I stop, I'm going to be here for at least half an hour, potentially longer. I might seize up. I've got 2 days to go. This isn't worth it. Let's just go find a Tesco's or a petrol station and do that.
Yeah. You do have to be selfish with these challenges, though. If you're, because you can't let it derail you. That was something when I was doing the marathon training. I went to a talk from a guy who'd done sort of dozens of marathons, and he was like, "Well, you know, day before the challenge, before the run, you know, you need to be selfish. You can't." You know, he said he did one marathon where he ended up being out late with his partner at the time, and it ruined the marathon for him because he hadn't slept, you know. And it's like, well, actually, you know, in these situations, you do kind of need to be ruthless.
Yeah.
Especially if it is, you know, and if you're looking after your mental health as well, you do kind of have to be a bit ruthless as well and look after yourself, you know.
It's a weird one, isn't it? I think some people might opt to do that, keep everyone happy option, and especially challenges, it's not, you can't do that. And you know, whether it's the 24-hour TTs or riding across the country or whatever it is, they're like, especially with the TTs, the selfishness that goes into them, you know, because you have, there's a whole team that goes behind those kind of races, you know. There'll be, and the reason why there's a whole team is to take as much of it away from me doing the race. So there'll be someone sorting out food, someone keeping an eye on like the bike, make sure the bike's okay, someone checking that I'm actually all right. And you need all of that, because it's just, otherwise it becomes a series of things that you have to think about, when all I need to think about is riding a bike as hard as I can for a day. That's it. I don't want to be thinking about what I need to eat, how much I need to drink. I just need someone to go drink that, eat that. And then it's the same thing, getting a good night's sleep before, because you never sleep that well before anything, whether it's a marathon, you know, you're doing a sporty, whatever it is, you're never going to, because part of it's like anticipation, nerves, excitement, all of that combined stops you sleeping, but you need to like try and sleep as well as you can in the lead up to it.
Yeah.
I think there's this, I don't know if it's a thing, but I always feel like you can like bank sleep. So if you like sleep well, like the week before, if you don't sleep well the night before, you've kind of banked it up a bit.
I think that's, I think that's true. I think you definitely feel it physically and mentally, don't you? So important. But yeah, and I think that sort of team situation is a good analogy for you, you know, your mental health as well. If you need to focus on your own well-being, it really helps to have other people around you that can take away some of the other, you know, some of the other obstacles, whether it's just simple stuff like, you know, food, or you know, having some, you know, having one stress taken off you, something mundane to allow you to kind of just have a break or focus on your own well-being.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I did with the 107 challenge, which was also very intentional, being aware of mental health, was I front loaded the rest days.
Yeah,
physically I knew I'd need them, and ironically front loading them, it followed the Tour de France on the rest days basically, but I front loaded it because I knew that I'm going to need them more at the start of the challenge. But then I back loaded meeting my friends and seeing friends. Very intentionally made the route on the way back down pass to like cut two or three of my like really close friends, so that they would come out and ride, or I'd stay near them or whatever it was, so that I'd catch up with them and see how they were, just because I knew that that would be a motivator to make sure it was finished and I did the challenge. So that, for me, that worked out very well. It meant that there was something to look forward to. So I basically, like, tactically, when I got to Bristol, which was the first 5 days, which were bloody hard, I stayed with family. So that was good. And then the next point I saw a friend was in the Lake District, and that was also really good because that's hard riding around there. And it was a hard day or so before that. And then the next point was basically gone up to John O'Groats, and I was on my way back down. So it's from Edinburgh to Newcastle was the next point. And that Scotland leg was so brutal. So that was really good as well to have seen them then around Edinburgh. And then it was sort of like dotted all the way back down on the way home when I was knackered. People probably take that side of it for granted, I think. I don't think my mates really knew how important that side of it was either, actually. They were all like obviously quite excited to see me and everything like that, but I don't think they knew how important it was for me to see them.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, yeah, it's that you feel that you're not alone in those moments and have something to look forward to as well.
Yeah.
Again, I guess it's that's but like your mental health as well. It's like if there's things that you know that will help you feel better down the road, then you know, planning ahead to have those kind of those breakers down the line, something you can go to that'll give you some respite, then yeah, it's always good to have that planned ahead, or you know, have an emergency plan, an emergency kit.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I did do was I similarly, when you say emergency kit, as I posted like stuff to my friends, so I had spares on the whole trip. And that was so useful to have. It's like fresh kit, you know,
gels,
whatever it was. There was some at places that didn't have to carry everything all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny how like I probably didn't appreciate how much, especially the anxiety side of it, was going to affect me during that challenge. I definitely didn't appreciate it. And feel that I managed to sort of control it the best that I could. And it was something that I definitely struggled with, I think, for a fair while afterwards, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you concerned about it coming back?
Yeah, a bit. I'm concerned that it could and will come back, but I feel I'm quite accepting that it will. It's kind of part of the parcel of the sort of things that I do. These challenges are emotionally really hard, and as we pointed on slightly a little bit earlier, it's not necessarily just during the challenge. It is that like massive low that you get after them. And that's the thing that I think a lot of people maybe are aware of when you know, they do these kind of things, but might not necessarily know how to combat them. And previously in the past, I'd just go and plow and plan another challenge, and that's a distraction. But actually, it's much more about kind of accepting the situation you're in and talking about it to friends, family, whoever it is, and being very open and honest about the situation and allowing yourself, like, it is almost like grieving in a way, because you've completed something that's, you know, absorbed your life for whether it's a marathon or whether it's riding across a country. You've had to prepare for it and train for it, and there's so much work's gone into that emotionally and physically. And then you're kind of grieving it because it's done.
Yeah.
And so I feel like grief is something that people don't accept, and it's really important that that's natural. You know?
Yeah. I think, yeah, you build up to it so much as well, and you prepare yourself for, you know, it's coming. And then when it's gone, you know, there's a bit of a vacuum, isn't there? Mm-hmm. You know, any kind of major psychological moment or physical moment is gonna leave you with that once it's passed, you know. And then you're kind of like, what's next? How do I fill that void? And obviously, if you don't know, then there's some definitely some negative things that can take that place. So having a go-to afterwards is really important.
It's my pet hate question that I get asked a lot is what's next. I hate it because I don't.
I've literally just got off the bike.
So. And it's normally what's next. And my normal response is what's next? I don't know, I'm going to have a pizza or something. That's what's next.
Yeah.
What's literally the next thing I'm going to do? But I can understand why people always want to know what next is, because we're in a very strange world that everyone's hungry for, you know. As someone who's a large proportion of my life is out there on social media, people are always hungry to see what you're going to do and what you know, what's next. And sometimes it's really important to just kind of accept the moment you're in and decompress and don't worry about what's next. I mean, for me, like this year, like there's been so many points where races or challenges have had to be cancelled and replanned or rescheduled, and they might be rescheduled for like a couple of months or it might be a year. Like one of the races that I wanted to do this year, which would have been in October, was rescheduled to October 2021. Like it was cancelled in early summer. So
yeah.
there's like this whole kind of thing of like you have to just understand that everything ebbs and flows in the way that it should, and you can't, if you can't control it, you need to try and not allow that to affect you so much mentally, in my opinion.
Yeah,
it's hard.
Yeah, well, it's that thing, isn't it, I was talking about before, the control thing, you know, control the controllables. You can't affect the events happening or not, you know, you just have to be able to roll with the punches. And just to go back to the social media thing, because I was going to ask you about that as well, and like how that impacts you, like in terms of your mental health and like the positives and negatives of having quite a lot of your life online.
Yeah, it comes across that a lot of my life is online, but I'm actually incredibly private. There's a lot of things I don't share on social media. I only share really the cycling side of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually do a lot of painting. Very few people know that. I'm in a long-term relationship. Very few people know that. Like, there's lots of things which I don't talk about.
They won't go on. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's intentional. I don't talk about them on social media because I don't... It's not that I don't want to. It's not appropriate.
No.
It's hard. It's very hard. I find that I have to decompress from it and just like not go on to any form of social media for like a week or so every now and then, because it becomes, I think people get obsessed with it. And my one of the things for me that I've always really tried hard to do, and I very strongly feel that I do it, is be honest and genuine across everything. Like, if I'm having a shit day, I'll be honest about it. I'm having a bit of a shit time, or something's pissed me off, I'll be honest about it. I'm not going to beat around the bush. And, you know, with the brands that I get to work with, which I'm incredibly lucky to work with, and what has been so important to me is like, and I stated it with the brands from the start, that it's not a you and it's not a me and you relationship. It's not separate. It's an us. And, you know, we have to, you know, if there's problems, we talk through it together. If there's things that are equally, if there's good things, we talk through it together. And it should be a friendship, not like a person and a brand. It's so important. And,
yeah,
you know, you get approached so often. I probably get a message, I reckon, like on a daily basis going like, oh, we'll send you X. And in return, can you do Y amount of posts about it? And blah blah blah, and I just turn it down all the time because I just don't think it just doesn't work for me. It's like, I was trying to explain it to someone recently as well. It's like, there's people who do things for the quick, easy gains, and there's people that do things for long-term gains. Yeah. And for me, what's way more important is work with brands that are brands that I would use anyway. Like the kit I wear, the bikes I ride, the componentry I have on the bikes, like helmets I wear, it's stuff that I would have bought anyway because I like it. So straight away, it's easy to then like the products and want to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does become, and I think that I try to make sure that comes across that way. But for me, social media is tricky because you do get people who can be very negative towards you, and I'm very lucky I don't get it very often. So, but I know a lot of people who do get it a lot. And the problem is that people forget that behind one of these is a human being, you know, it doesn't matter whatever is being pushed out there. It's a human being. And I was thinking about it this morning, actually. It was like, in a business sense. So like, so I'm now basically working freelance, and for me, part of that is I've, you know, designed a few little bits and bobs myself, and I've been selling them myself anyway, like the Zero Lemon caps and a couple of t-shirts and stuff. I was thinking about this morning, if someone bought a cap, bless you.
Thank you.
That was a good sneeze.
Yeah. So I was trying to keep it in, but
But yeah, like this morning, someone bought one of the cycling caps, and it made, every time someone buys one, I genuinely smile and I'm like, yes. And like, I'm thinking, every small brand is in the same position. Like when someone buys something, you're like, fuck yeah. Like someone's bought it. Compared to like, if you're like a multinational company and it's like, no one has that emotive connection to it. And no. There's definitely a lot of strengths and weaknesses to social media. I like to think that I try my best to use it for its strengths, which is to try and engage and cause discussion about things that hopefully help other people, whether that is how you clean your bike to how you deal with a friend who's decided to take their own life. Like the whole spectrum, from the very hard to talk to the very easy to talk to things. And I feel like, by all means, people can call me out on it if I'm wrong, but I feel like I seem to be managing that quite well and being able to help encourage other people to open up and discuss things, judging by the messages that I get from people who are saying like, oh, you know, this has really helped that you've talked about this or been open or honest about X, Y, Z. It's little things like the other day I was talking about my nerve damage in my hand, which is, I don't talk about it a lot because it's just something I don't need to talk about. But actually, riding electronic gearing for me changes cycling for me because I don't suffer from pain. So I very openly talk about it. And a guy messaged me saying like, thank you, basically saying, thanks so much for sharing this. I broke my wrist recently and I never thought I'd be able to ride a bike properly again. And I was like, okay, that's a success then, because you've realized that this could be a way to help you as a cyclist to allow you to cycle more.
Yeah, and that can be a big part of his life. You know, it could be the only way he gets out of the house or whatever. So,
Another one is that, like, I use Aftershocks headphones, which, and they, you know, they support me as well. And I was funny about this one at first because I was like, I'm part deaf. So headphones to me, generally it's pointless. Like I have these like sitting next to my desk. I never wear them. I have them sitting next to my desk because some of the podcasts I've recorded, having the mic is actually really useful. But these are just Apple headphones, I never use the left headphone because I can't fucking hear properly out of my left ear. So it's pointless. And if I do, everything just sounds shit anyway. But Aftershocks ones are bone conduction headphones. They sit here.
Right.
And I said to them, I want to try them before agreeing to work with you because I struggle with headphones. And they were like, yep, fine, here's a set. And I said to a couple of friends, you tell me what would be good to listen to as like a test. And they were like, Bohemian Rhapsody. Like, good suggestion. And I was proper blown away because it meant I could hear music like I'd never heard it before because it doesn't go into my ear the normal way. It's bone conduction.
Yeah.
It actually meant I felt like I could hear music properly out of my left ear. And so for me, like that is a massive difference. And being able to talk about that with that brand, that's a positive. Like that is a really positive thing. And I managed to get them to give me a set to provide to my friend's son who has, I think he's type 1 diabetic, type 2 diabetic. I can't remember what way around it is, if I'm honest.
Same, sorry. I think,
he's type 1. Diabetic. And he has learning difficulties and stuff, and he struggles with his hearing as well. And I managed to get Aftershocks to send him a pair because I knew it would help him for being able to listen to music and play games on his phone and stuff like that. And so that is where social media is good, is when you can use it to that benefit, not to benefit in yourself, to benefit other people through your own exposure, in my opinion.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, it definitely does have that power to change. Just being able to communicate with that many people so quickly. But yeah, can be a double-edged sword sometimes. But I think it's definitely helped Movember, and it helps me in my job, just being able to connect with people on there as well. It's just it's an easier way to communicate, and you know, I guess it's all of our supporters, it's their main way of, you know, asking for donations or it's, you know, sharing things about their own experiences and things like that. So yeah, always conscious of that in terms of like communications and, you know, what we're asking people to do. How easy is it to sort of share on social media? Because that tends to work better in terms of the sort of raising funds and awareness side of things. So
yeah, and like one of the things, or a couple of things I really like is the app is, it's just super slick. It's super smart. I like that you've got the Mo tracker on it, so you take a photo every day. I have it set up so it reminds me, because I'm useless at remembering that. And that you can set up a team, and you know, I set up a small team which anyone could join. And
yeah,
the stories that have come out of that, like from hearing why the other guys in it are fundraising,
yeah,
kind of took me back quite a lot. Actually, I was a bit choked up about one or two of them. And
yeah,
you know, it's very, very honest. People have written it very honestly why they were fundraising. And you know, putting it as a team meant that a group of guys could all, and women can get involved in it as well, but it meant, it just happens that mine's all got a bunch of guys in it, but it meant that we could all kind of do it together, which was really nice.
Yeah, that's one of the best things about Movember, is the kind of camaraderie and the that comes out of it, because it is a social activity as well. You know, growing moustache or whatever you do, you know, whether it's a big challenge or you're hosting an event or whatever, you know, it does bring people together, and then it does bring out those stories as well. You know, like what you're talking about before, you know, everyone is touched by cancer or mental health issues in some way. You know, you know, 1 in 4 people experience a mental health issue in a year, so it will affect most people, or you'll know someone who's affected. So those stories do start to come out with Movember. People will write up on their page and you'll be like, oh well, you never told me about that. It's like, well, you know, we've never had that conversation, or you know, I just keep it to myself, or you know, it's normally something I've just sort of got on with, or you know, put in the past, although I still think about it. And then it comes out, and then you learn something about each other, and it brings you closer together as well, because you both got this shared experience. Everyone's gone through something difficult at some point. You just have to wait for it to come out.
Yeah,
and give them the opportunity to do it.
Yeah. One of the ways I like to kind of, like, I got told off for not doing this in the podcast by that, so I'm going to make sure I'm making sure I do it again. I was asked for like 5 tips or hacks towards the end of the podcast, and it can be anything. It can be cooking related, it could be exercise related, it could be technology related, DIY related, anything. 5. The thing is I actually think that this could be quite easy, bearing in mind the discussion of most of this podcast of what we're talking about, but I'm gonna leave it to you.
Oh god, 5. Sure, 5. That's quite a lot, actually.
That's why it's 5, because like 1, 2, or 3 is really easy to check out.
Oh god, this is taking me well out of my comfort zone. I'm terrible at telling people what to do. Well, I mean, Movember literally has our 5 things we tell men to do.
There you go.
For their health. Okay. Now this is a challenge still, because I can never remember all 5. one of them is obviously talk more, have more conversations. 2, know thy nuts. So getting guys to check their balls, because testicular cancer, we haven't really talked about that yet, but knowing what's normal could save your life. Move, exercise, obviously. We all know the benefits, physical and mental. Make man time. So spending time with your friends is good, or being, you know, social interactions is good. It's one of our sort of key metrics for good mental health, is having lots of social connections. There's usually a correlation between the two. And the fifth one, damn it, no, I can't remember. I always forget the fifth one. I'll just have to make one up then.
Yeah.
Grow a mustache. There we go.
Because it makes you a strong individual.
Obviously, growing a mustache isn't necessarily a sign of masculinity or strength, but it can make you feel good. Especially if, you know what, we often say the worst mustaches are the ones that get the most attention. So, even if you think you can't grow one, give it a go. You'll be surprised to see what happens. Probably people are taking the piss out of you a lot, but, you know, at least it generates conversations.
And one of the things that I also really like that Movember did this year is the Movember masks.
Yes, they've been a massive hit, actually. Very popular.
Because I wear mine when I go to the shop all the time because no one can tell otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we thought of that quite early, actually. It's quite a long process getting that sorted out. But it seemed a natural thing to do. It's like, well, one of the big things is, you know, going into the office with your, you know, with your moustache and it being a conversation starter. And we can obviously, that's been taken away. Mm. Can't even do it on public transport. So, you know, that seemed like an easy win. But yeah, people have loved them. So I think we'll keep those going. Should see them around the world. I've not seen any out on the streets yet, but I guess I've not been out that much. But yeah, hoping they'll still continue to be of use. Or maybe we will.
It's actually a good mask though. Like, it's actually really well made and it's like sits nice on your face.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was a big thing about kind of our merch and everything we do in kind of design wise, we try and do well, not just put out sort of unsustainable, one use kind of things. But yeah, my friend's mum made me a mask, so I usually wear that one. I haven't worn Movember one that much recently.
Yeah, I've got one that was made by a friend, which I probably should wear, but it's also bright blue, and I quite like the Movember one because it's black as well.
Yeah.
It's pretty neat and smart.
Yeah, I mean, it tends to, you know, I think it's good for guys as well, having something that's, you know, black and white's always, never goes out of fashion, does it, black, so.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right, actually. I don't think it ever has gone out of fashion. No. There was definitely times, like, it's like I have a degree in colour coordination. It's a really weird degree to have.
A whole degree?
Yeah, I was paid for when I was working in architecture. The company paid for it because basically you do a test to understand how good your eyesight is, and the color detection is a very important in design. So that's like detecting like what that white is compared to that white, for example, like very, very specific things.
Yeah. So,
if you scored over a certain percentage, they effectively paid for you to do this degree in color coordination and color detection.
Yeah.
I got 96%, which is ridiculously high. And
that's your superpower.
It's my superpower. I may be half deaf, but I've got really good eyes when it comes to choosing colors. And anyway, one of the things that came out in, I remember it because there's one color which I really hate, and it's red. I hate the color red. Okay. It's an aggressive color. It sparks anxiety in people. It's notoriously a color which is seen in a negative light unless you're more, you know, if you're from China, for example, where it's a lucky color. But
yeah,
generally, it's quite often seen as a negative color. And one of the things that came out in that test that they said is three colors that will never go out of fashion is black, white, and red. Mm. I was like, why red? And apparently, it makes sense because like red is one of the most popular car colors.
And I guess there's a psychological thing, isn't it? I guess probably something kind of primeval in your reaction to red.
Yeah.
You know, in blood or, you know, dangerous insects and things like that. You probably have this primordial, you know, reaction to it. So
yeah,
maybe it's ingrained.
Yeah, that's the reason why I have a yellow wall is because yellow is supposed to relax you. It's a calming color and it's a happy color. So I literally have a bright yellow wall in my flat.
Yeah, but nice.
I like the color yellow, and it is, it's a happy color. It's sunflower yellow, basically. It's just nice.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's definitely, I'm very affected by colors, and it, part of it is because of that degree, because I learned a lot about it. And yeah, yellow is always one that I'm always drawn to, it because it's such a warm, it just reminds me of summer and good things.
Yeah, of course.
And red is just, I find it really aggressive. Like, even the freaking postman delivery letters are red.
Oh yeah,
it's such an aggressive color. But post vans aren't red anymore in London. A lot of them aren't. Have you seen the green ones?
No, I haven't. No, I've only seen red ones.
They're in green now.
Huh.
Because they're electric. And we're going green and they paint them green.
Right. Great marketing. Yeah.
Yeah, well done. Well done. Royal Mail, they've nailed it. Yeah.
Yeah, we've done some work with them in the past. The Movember campaign. We had a, I don't know if we had it this year. I think we had it last year as well. They did add a Movember stamp. So
that's nice.
The mail got, you know, Movember postmark. It's cool.
Oh, like a proper stamp.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was maybe built into their sort of, you know, franking machines or whatever it is that the mail goes through. So,
yeah,
you know, millions of pieces of mail with a mustache on it. They do it for lots of charities.
That's really nice.
Yeah,
I guess it's like, it's the same thing, isn't it? Like we've said quite a lot, is like creating discussion points, and something like that is a discussion point, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just those little touchstones and just touch points and having, you know, I guess you probably know stuff about marketing as well. I don't really know a huge amount about it, but, you know, it's becoming acquainted with a brand and a message. And, you know, we've done pretty well of people knowing Movember is growing a mustache for November, but how do we get beyond that sort of superficial point to the serious side? And, you know, we've had to do a lot of work the last few years to get beyond just the, you know, you see a mustache, you think Movember, you want to see a mustache, think, you know, men's health kind of thing. So but those little kind of marketing pieces are the sometimes the first step into someone's consciousness, and or literally the first bit that comes into their home, you know.
Yeah. Amazing. Oh, I'm gonna wrap it up there because you've got another meeting as well. Busy man.
Yeah, that's a good point actually. So I was switched off my Outlook. So
yeah. So thank you so much for talking with me for the last hour and a bit. I really appreciate it. Okay. I hope this podcast helps to encourage people to reach out a bit more and opens up some discussion opportunities. And please look at some of the really, really good resources out there, especially on the Movember website. I'll put links in this, which has a lot of that in it as well. So if you know anyone that you need to have one of these kind of conversations with, that might be a tough conversation, please check out some of Movember's resources to help you, to guide you through that.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Chris.
Cheers, dude.